Western and Southern Financial Group. Put our financial strength behind you. Visit westernsouthern.com. All right, welcome into another edition of the Jim Day Podcast. Cam Miller, thanks for playing, son. Appreciate it. And thank you for supporting this podcast, however you are listening. And please spread the word.
Would you do that for a friend?
Thank you very much. I'm excited about today's episode because I wouldn't have this guy on because, as you know, if you know me, I love history in general, whether it be sports or just plain old world or American history. And this guy is dialed into the history of the Reds. He is the all-around Reds historian, the former executive director of the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum, and the current author of his latest book, Red Leg Memories, The Reds of the 50s and 60s. Welcome in, Greg Rhodes. Greg, how are you?
Thank you, Jim. I'm doing good. I hope you are. And it's good to be here. I've been a big fan of the podcast for a long time, so
appreciate that.
To be on.
Thank you very much. You got a Crosley Field shirt on. That is near and dear to my heart. We're in the former Crosley room right now.
That's right. That's right. So all around us. It's all around
it's
us.
It's the symmetry.
And the Crosley Terrace out front. And yeah. Big Clue and Joe Nuxall and Frank Robinson and early Lernie Lombardi.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, now, this newest book. Now, I've said before that if I was to go back in history, because I would, you know, when I was a kid, the Big Red Machine was in my wheelhouse. Some of the earliest memories as a child are at Riverfront Stadium, but I never got the Crosley Field experience. So if I'm going to go back, put me like 56, maybe.
56?
Was that Frank Robinson's rookie year, I think?
That was. It was Frank's rookie year.
Put me at Crosley Field in like 1956, and that would be, I'd be a really happy dude.
Hey, you know, the first thing, you'd be thrilled and excited to go to the ballpark, going through the west end of Cincinnati, but trying to find a place to park. That would have been your first major challenge, because that ballpark, when it was built in 1912, those streets were not built for for car traffic. Yeah. They were narrow, crisscross. It was difficult parking, and there were a lot of issues around the future of Crosley Field, and the parking and traffic issues were really paramount. But being at the ballpark, all right, you're walking up to the ballpark, and just the sights and sound of the park, that red brick exterior for the most part. The center field wall. If you parked out along Western Avenue, which is where I-75 goes today, there actually were a couple of entrances on that back side, so you could come in out through the outfield, especially if you're sitting on the bleachers. But then to get up into the bleachers, and the ushers, the guys sell, not the ushers, but the concession guys, going through the stands selling all sorts of Cincinnati beers.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, get moody with Hudie. That kind of stuff. Rock and roll with Hudepaw. I mean, some of the same things you heard later on, but those were the days when, and burger beer, and, so you had that sight and sound and the smells and the concessions. Of course, that was in the days when you had, you know, people sitting right next to you smoking cigars. There were a lot of sights and sound and smells of that ballpark. And the one of the really distinctive sounds, especially when there were a lot of kids in the ballpark, was that the upper deck out beyond the bases had been built, there was an addition that was added onto the upper deck. And the addition, the regular seats were concrete based, but those upper deck was metal, the upper deck extensions. Yeah. And so you could sit there and pound your feet away.
Yeah, makes a noise.
And just make, that would reverberate, and you'd hear that noise throughout the ballpark when there was a rally going on or after a home run or something like that.
That is beautiful.
And then you had Ronnie Dale at the organ, and Peanut Jim outside hawking peanuts. I mean, it was just a great scene at Old Crosley.
Oh, I love that. Just the city of Cincinnati, but a small town feel. I love it. Now, when I was working in Tampa, Florida, and I came back to Ohio, came back and started working in Cincinnati in 2000.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Columbus.
Columbus, okay.
C-bus
so
guy.
I
grew up a Reds fan. And, it's in my blood.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
we
were down 71.
Make the track down 71 a thousand times growing up. So, it's been in my blood as an Ohio guy. But when I came back and started working and living in Cincinnati, one of the first things I did, because I'm a history nerd, is I went to look, okay, where was Crosley Field? And I was...
couldn't find it.
I knew where it was.
Oh, you knew where, yeah.
But I was highly disappointed that there wasn't any markers. But I know there's a home plate like in a warehouse or maybe outside of one, but yeah. I was so disappointed that they just kind of wiped away the history and there's very little left, any markers there.
Well, now, you know, in the last few years, there's a social service agency called City Gospel Mission that moved onto that site. And they, unlike previous owners, really embraced the fact that they were on that site, and they have, we cooperated with them, the Reds Hall of Fame, in putting together a little Crosley Field. We'll have to go over there someday.
Yeah,
a little Crosley Field tribute, and
I haven't been there since you've done that. I knew that existed.
But you're right. I mean, for years and years and years. I mean, when they demolished it, they took it down. I mean, they sold off a few, you know, seats and bricks from the old ballpark. And
it was a parking lot, right?
And then it was a parking lot for years. And then there was light industrial buildings in there. But, yeah, I mean, for example, those famous historic light towers. First night game in Major League history.
Yeah, how could you throw
what
those
the heck
away?
Happened to those?
How could you throw them away?
I could never find out exactly what happened to those.
I know there's
towers.
A few lights that are left from it.
Yeah,
that,
but those were the what's
were those
left.
The replacements?
No, but no. Those were like little lights, interior lights inside the ballpark. Those were not on the light stanchions.
Oh, see now that.
See, and I know it's sad. I don't know how. I cannot figure that out.
I know they were ready to get out of there. I mean, they're like, you know, it had run its course,
exactly.
And they're like, we don't need this.
And they got,
we don't need this junk.
Brand new riverfront waiting for them.
Yeah.
But it is.
But
it
still,
is,
they should have preserved. I mean, there's so much history that was in that ballpark. That's, I mean.
Yeah.
Ugh.
You see some of the demolition footage, and it's like, don't do that.
Well, I'd mentioned Cam Miller. He did the theme songs here.
I know Cam.
He's one of my favorite followers. He'll put on some pictures of the outline of where Crosley Field was now over a
set. So you can see
over
it.
Top. Yeah.
Right.
So.
And you're right about home plate is, in fact, the home plate is in an alley.
Yeah.
And it is painted. The outline of it's painted.
Right.
But you got to know where you gotta know where you're looking.
I was literally walking around for 5 or 10 minutes. Just I'm like, okay, it's probably close to here. And it was right. Yeah. I'm like in the alley. I'm like, this is it.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. I remember we took I did tours there back when I was running the Hall of Fame. We would do tours there for big groups and walk them around the site. And the side of home plate always surprised everybody because it just. You know, in your mental picture of it, it was like, really? It was right here. But when we found out exactly where it was, then we had the opportunity to measure, to confirm the distance, because you could walk that distance off from there to the left field, where the left field wall was, which was right on York Street, that little alley that ran right behind the left field wall. And it was right at 330 feet, which the left field foul line was 328.
Yeah.
So we were pretty sure we were within just
with an incline.
Right. And you know, vestiges of that incline survived after they tore it down. They just didn't take it out. But now it's all gone, too. So,
And the scoreboard with the.
But look at, you know, Riverfront.
Clock, I mean, they. Right. Oh, my God.
But Riverfront suffered the same thing. I mean, there's not a whole lot left of. I mean, the Riverfront site. One of the things that's interesting, when you walk into the Hall of Fame, if you come in through the entrance that faces the ballpark, that's roughly where the left field foul pole was at Riverfront. And the outfield.
We need to put the foul poles up.
Yeah, you know, wouldn't that be great? I'd love to see us do that.
Yeah.
And I'd love to paint the outfield wall.
Because the Rose Garden is out there where Pete's hit. Approximately where it's hit.
And first base is in the Christian Moore line.
Right, and home plate
the
is in the parking garage down below. I went down there and stood there, which I is
chills,
a history.
Right?
Yeah,
I
stood there by the home plate where the home plate was, and you're in a covered garage. I'm like,
I know, but we need to bring
the
that
great players.
You need to bring that marker up to
bring
the,
it
just
up.
To street level or what is now, you know, the,
bring it up. Yeah. And I would giving Cam another shout out here. He took a picture of where the left field or right field foul pole would be and said, you know, we need to work on this. How cool would it be to put up those foul poles
on
where they are? Just
Yeah.
anyways, that's another project.
Well, it's not, you know, and you go to other cities, and some of them have done a pretty good job of marking their old ballparks. Yeah. Like some of them haven't. You just, you never know. And so, but now here you go. The 1869 Red Stockings, right? Our, yeah. our namesake.
Right.
Where did they play? In front of Union Terminal.
Right.
And there is a marker out there.
Is
at
there?
Least. Yeah, there okay. is a plaque that marks the location.
I've never seen that.
Been
in Union Terminal.
Well, it's
many
out,
times.
You know where the fountain is? It's sort of
yeah.
at the foot of the
oh,
fountain.
Okay.
Way out there. But that's, yeah, so that ballpark is marked, at least the site.
Right.
And we know where Crosley was, but there's a couple other ballparks in the interim that were, I mean, we know where they were, but there's no markers.
All right, people. You people, influences, influencers, easy for me to say, influencers out there with a little coin to spend. Can we get this done? Can we band together and preserve our history and go back and let's do some markers? All right, that's
All right.
another tangent. This book, thank you for the copy, by the way. Red Leg Memories, The Reds of the 50s and 60s, your ninth book, I believe. A great Father's Day gift, by the way, coming up. Let's quickly give a plug. Where can they get this book,
okay,
first of all?
They can get that.
Yeah.
You can get it online at Amazon. You can get it, and then the Reds Hall of Fame. I would recommend you get
there
the
you
Reds
go.
Hall of Fame, because for one thing, we should all support the Reds Hall of Fame.
Absolutely.
And secondly, most of the copies they have in there, I've signed them. So you'll get a signed copy if you get in there. And then
Very
Joseph
nice.
Beth Bookstores has them. So,
okay.
so those are the three locations.
Awesome. Okay. You've got Pete Rose on the front. You've got Frank Robinson. You've got Jim Maloney. If you're
yep.
going to write about the 50s and 60s, yep. that's pretty good.
Yeah. And then we got three more guys on the back
we
there.
Got
Clue.
Here on the back. We got Clue. One of the most underrated players in Reds history, Veda Benson.
Veda, yep.
Bench and Big Clue.
You know, I'll tell you, in doing this book and talking to fans over the years, I think Veda Pinson was one of the most favored Red player.
Completely underrated.
Guy was just so popular.
Yeah. And I didn't see him play. I'm just going on stories and anecdotes and people that did see him play.
Yeah. He, you know, like they say that about Cesar Geronimo playing the outfielder, guys that are really mm-hmm. kind of just graceful. And that's the way Pinson was. He
yeah.
just glided across the outfield.
Well, take me through this book. How is it laid out? You go, looks like year by year?
Yeah, we're doing year by year. And in fact, it's modeled a little bit after the first comprehensive history of the Reds, which was a year by year history that came out in 1947. And so when I started this book, even though it says the Reds of the 50s and 60s, surprise, you'll get the 1948 and 49 season
yeah.
too. So I had thought, Jim, when I first started this, that I was going to bring it up to current times year by year by year.
Yeah.
And I got up through about the mid-50s and realized I was going to have a
2,000-page book. Yeah.
It was like,
this is pretty thick as well. And
yeah.
it's for those out there, there are pictures.
Yes.
So the first thing I have, there are pictures, which I could look at old pictures, black and white pictures, just all day. Even if it's just a guy standing there, I just love them so much.
You know, most of the pictures in that book came from the collection of the photos that we have at the Reds Hall of Fame, and they were taken by a guy named Jack Klumpy, who was the old photographer for the old Cincinnati Post and Times Star during this time period. And he shot spring training. And he shot every season from about 1957 through early 70s.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And he kept all his negatives, which we now have digitized. And,
oh, you did? Oh,
yeah.
That's great.
And so and when we got the negatives, they were all in little sleeves with the date of the game on them. I mean, unbelievable.
Wow.
Unbelievable the way that he organized them and cataloged them. And so, I was able to benefit significantly,
yeah.
and well, readers will be able to benefit as they look through these photos, because there's a lot of photos in here that have not been used very, very much. So,
wow, I'm looking at 1965, which was a great year because some dork that has a podcast was born that year. But you got a picture of Johnny Bench here. I'm randomly going through this, wearing number 53.
Yes, yes, old John. He got rid of the three.
Yes, he did.
When he first came up in spring training there, he was wearing a different number.
Yeah.
Until he got number five.
What is, and this is going to be hard for you there's so much
What's
good
your
stuff
favorite
up here.
Part of
What's
that?
Your, you knew it was coming? That's not an easy question, is it? All of it?
Well, I would say, you know, there's a couple of things that really intrigued me about this book was finding out about some people that you just didn't know much about who played really significant roles. And one of those was a scout. You know, where do players get scouted, right? And back in the, and now we've got the draft, and so it's a pretty mechanized, routinized thing. But back in the 50s,
you had to do some legwork.
You were dependent very much upon who your scout was and the context they had in that part of the world. And if you look at that Reds lineup in the late 50s, there was a guy in Northern California, a scout named Bobby Matic. He was a player, but not much of a player. Went into scouting. The Reds hired him in the early 50s, and they assigned him Northern California. Frank Robinson is going to high school in Oakland. Veda Pinson goes to the same high school in Oakland. Tommy Harper, Jim Maloney is out in Fresno.
Yeah.
This guy, Bobby Matic, signed all of those guys, plus many, many more, like Kurt Flood, who didn't have a long career with the Reds, but wound up being a terrific player. But Bobby Matic signed all. I mean, he's got an all-star lineup of guys that he signed.
And when you look back, Frank Robinson and Maloney and Pinson alone is a career maker.
Right, but the guy was instrumental in helping the Reds, really launch the 60s, which was sort of the prelude to the Big Red Machine. The Reds in the 50s, it was interesting, because when I went to write this book, my wife is saying to me, now how many times did they win a pennant in the 50s and 60s? Once. How are you going to sell a book when they only won one? Well, because she was used to my other book, like about the Big Red Machine, where we did a little better. But anyway, so the Reds were pretty mediocre in the 50s. But once you sign Robinson and Pinson, you get young Pete Rose coming in the organization in the early 60s. You get some really good pitching, Maloney, Jimmy O'Toole, Bob Perky, whatever. They put that lineup. They became really good in the early 60s.
And the Ragamuffins.
Although they only won that one year, the Ragamuffin Reds, the Miracle on Western Avenue, the 61 Reds, they still – though, had started to put together what became the guts of the Big Red Machine.
Yeah.
And so that Bobby Matic's influence, as it turns out, his influence was really significant, I think, in helping the Reds revive and become much more of a powerhouse in the National League.
Tell people how great a player Frank Robinson was.
For 10 years, he averaged hit 300, averaged 30 home runs, scored 100 runs, and drove in 100 runs. That was his average season. I mean, if you look at his career stats as the Reds, he had 10 years, and you look at all those, he had about 1,000 runs scored, 1,000 RBIs, 300 home runs, 300 hitter. I mean, you can't find another 10-year stretch.
Oh, he was washed up, though.
He's old 30. Now, that is, and for folks that are maybe listening and don't know that story, the reason Frank Robinson didn't have a longer career with the Reds is that Bill DeWitt, who was then the general manager, president general manager of the club, owner of the club, he and Frank just didn't. It was oil and water. They did not see eye to eye on anything. And then Frank was a tough guy. I mean, you probably know of Frank's reputation.
Very tough guy, hard edge, great man, but hard edge.
Yeah.
And, influenced, unfortunately, by the times, which it was not easy being an African-American baseball player in a town like Cincinnati at the time. Let's just be real about it.
Oh, right. I mean, and Frank had stories and all those guys from that time period did. And I think, in part, Frank was sort of the team representative. And a lot of times when the players had gripes, Frank would take them to management. And then Frank, with his salary, annual salary disputes and stuff. They didn't sign guys to multi-year contracts. Every year you kind of had to go through this. And he and DeWitt just were always butting heads. And I think after that 65 season, when the Reds had great hitting and their pitching really suffered, that he just figured, well, I can get rid of Frank Robinson, my nemesis, my problem, and I can get him, get some good pitching for him. So he made the deal. And during the negotiations and the trade and afterwards, he used the phrase, well, Frank was an old 30.
No, that quote.
And that just set Robinson off. Because Robinson, Robinson didn't drink. He didn't smoke. Mm-hmm. He didn't carouse. He said, you wanted to find me, you go to the bowling alley. I was at the bowling alley.
Yeah.
And so to call him an old 30 like he was washed up.
Oh, he went on to win the
Triple Crown.
Lead
the Orioles to the World Series victory in 66. Oh, God, it was terrible.
Gracious.
And DeWitt, basically, I wouldn't say that in and of itself ran him out of town, but Bill DeWitt was on the wrong side of Riverfront Stadium also. And that I cover that. That's really an interesting story, though, because as you noted earlier, Crosley Field isn't there anymore. I mean, Crosley Field was in its final stages in the 60s, and the Reds needed a new ballpark. And where was it going to be built? What kind of ballpark was it going to be? And DeWitt wanted the ballpark built out north in the northern suburbs, like out around Blue Ash.
Right.
He looked at the old Kings Island site on the way up 71
really?
North. He did not want to go down to the riverfront. He did not want to go downtown. But all
they're worried about flooding.
Well, that and plus, you know, the riverfront at that point was kind of a mess.
There wasn't anything.
It was
down
a mess,
there.
And it. He just did not. He couldn't envision the ballpark down there. The other part of the problem was in the mid '60s. What happens in Cincinnati sports? The Bengals.
Yeah.
The Bengals sign. You know, the NFL agrees to put an NFL franchise in here. Well. That meant now not only you were going to have a multi-purpose stadium. So all the movers and shakers in downtown Cincinnati, they all wanted this. They didn't want to build two stadiums. They wanted a multi-purpose stadium. They wanted it down on the river. And DeWitt didn't want to do either one of those things. And he would not sign the lease. And so he sold the club.
Ugh.
So the club was sold to a group of local investors, kept the team in town, and their first big move was to hire Bob Housem as a general manager.
Hallelujah!
Woo!
One of the greatest Woo! Of all time. I mean, you talk about Reds history, you bring up like guys like Frank Robinson and Bench and Rose and Morgan and Perez and et cetera, but Bob Housem should be listed amongst those people.
Well, there were a lot of people that thought Bob should have been in the Hall of Fame
as a
general manager and owner of, I mean, he had that Cardinal franchise there in the mid '60s when they won the World Series a couple of times when Bob was there, and then he comes over here and pilots the Big Red Machine for 15 years.
Right.
I mean, he just had a heck of a run in baseball. He was one of a kind. Came out of small town Colorado. He had never, you know, I mean, he played a little sandlot ball.
Hotbed.
Yeah.
Colorado
then. His family had done well and wound up being investors in the Denver Broncos. The Denver, what was the name of the Denver minor league franchise?
Zephyrs?
Anyway, he got involved with the Denver club out there, and they wound up buying Mile High Stadium.
Ah.
What ultimately became Mile High Stadium.
Yeah, which and the Reds Triple-A club played there
and
for
so
a minute.
Yeah, so he... that's kind of how he got his start, and and when he was out running the AAA club in Denver, he worked for Branch Rickey, because for a while it was the Pirates farm club, and he worked for George Weiss at the Yankees, because for a while it was the Yankees farm club.
Wow.
Now, George Weiss has more World Series rings than I think anybody. Like, he's got 15 or 18, because he was with the Yankees all during the 30s, mm-hmm. 40s, 50s. And then Branch Rickey, one of the great names so in all of baseball. So you got those two guys sort of as your mentor, you know, coming of age as a young kid in baseball. I mean that's a heck of a resume right there.
Yeah.
And so the Cardinals hired him, and then eventually the Reds hired him away from the Cardinals.
Wow. You know, I don't know why this popped in my head, but the stadium thing, Bill DeWitt not wanting to go to the riverfront and dragging his feet. And unfortunately, Marge dragged her feet, because this ballpark, Great American, can be where the Bengals stadium is. You would have had first dibs, and the suspension bridge would be in the outfield. That would be what you would be looking at. Anyways, that's a total tangent.
You're right. I mean, that tax levy passed largely because of the Reds, not because of the Bengals.
Right.
At that point in time. And you're right. Marge had... as somebody once described it to me, had a hard time moving from A to B to C. You know, just that sort of direct line thinking that we got to have here to get this thing off the ground. The Bengals are all buttoned up and ready to go, and it was just easier to start. They started with the Bengals, and then the Reds not only wound up with the second location, but also had less money.
And had to wedge it in there. And anyway.
So it wasn't
ideal. The Bengals stadium, the location, obviously very important, but not as important as the baseball view of the outfield.
Well, when you've got, you know, 6 months of baseball.
Yeah.
I mean, you got so many more baseball games.
I mean, the suspension bridge would be in the outfield. How
beautiful
would that be?
Right. But, I know. You look at those pictures from Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Gorgeous,
and we could have something similar. Now, if you want to get the downtown background, it would have had to go in northern Kentucky.
Right.
That's a different
which
story.
Wasn't
that's a
that
complete
one.
And just total tangent by me. I'm sorry, Greg. Let's get back to the 50s
and 60s. You're a history nerd. I understand.
It's peace knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk.
Life can throw a lot at us, but through all the ups and downs, your financial future will be ever gentle on your mind with Western and Southern. From life insurance to investments, our one-on-one guidance is customized for your needs today and in the future. Western and Southern, life insurance, retirement, and investments. Visit westernsouthern.com/restassured to get started today.
Ever smiling, never gentle on my mind.
Jim Day here. I've teamed up with Swift to talk about my favorite seasons, baseball and grilling, America's pastimes, where people come together to talk, to laugh, to revel in the joyous chaos of family and the shared love of these beautiful words.
Play ball!
And let's eat! This baseball season, ask for Swift Meats at your local grocer.
Good food, good moments. One great meal. Come together with Swift.
And you know what? That is what happens when you start doing these books. You think, yeah. Well, I'm going to do the, you know, I'm going to focus on this guy and this guy. And then all of a sudden, some guy that you, like Chico Ruiz, who is one of my favorite characters from the Reds from the yeah. 60s. I mean, he was just a laugh a minute. One-liners. I mean, he was a hit on the banquet stage. And you can imagine him today in social media world. He would just be yeah. a hoot. What a character. What a guy.
I've always thought about that. Guys back in the day that were characters, how they would be in social media today. They'd yeah. be gold.
Chico Ruiz. Bertie Tebbets, who was the manager of the Reds in the 50s, he was the one that gave Frank Robinson his, you know, put him in the starting lineup in 1956 and stuck with him. Bertie, same way. They'd say how Bertie would go to New York and he knew all the writers so well. He'd have stories for this writer and then he'd have stories for the guy at the Times and the Tribune and that, you know, just. He was really a consummate baseball man. He is the only manager that I know of in baseball who actually got a philosophy degree. he has a philosophy degree.
Wow.
And if you think about it, what better job do you, I mean, what where do you need a philosophy degree more
no doubt.
Than being a baseball man?
You know, Sparky Anderson kind of had a honorary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Think of it.
He was one of those guys that
really had some good sayings.
Yeah.
Could have been a philosopher.
I think Bertie was sort of in Sparky's mold. Feisty yeah. guy, but great with the press and great personality.
Right. All right. Big clue.
Big clue.
His number 18 hangs forever here, retired. Statue out front, Crosley Terrace. Famously wearing the no sleeves with the big
right.
guns hanging out.
Right.
Can you put into perspective for those that weren't alive then or haven't looked him up, just how big of a name Ted Kluszewski, not only in this town, he was a national name.
Well, he even got his name on three steakhouses here in Cincinnati, right?
yeah.
He ended up buying steakhouses here. Not only was he well-known on the baseball field, but in the culinary realm as well. But, yeah, when Clue came up, I mean, Clue had some so-so years when he first got started, mm-hmm. but he put together 3 or 4 years there, and with that physique of his—
yeah.
He was a terrific hitter. You know, he had more home runs than strikeouts for a season. He's hitting 50
wow,
home
isn't that
runs.
That a novel concept.
50 home runs, and he's only striking out 35 times
that's incredible.
Or whatever. So Clue had a terrific. I mean, he was very popular, very popular, and he was well known all throughout. Everybody knew Kluszewski all throughout baseball. He was the guy. He was the touchstone for interviews with other players. You know, does he hit the ball as hard as Kluszewski? What, you know, is he as strong as Kluszewski? I mean, he was baseball's iconic. He was their figurehead for about 3 or 4 years there in the mid-50s.
Yeah, and he was on some shows. I'd look back on YouTube and just see some of the game shows he was on.
Yeah, yeah. What's My Line?
What's My Line was
one of the best.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be a big name nationally to be, you know, granted there were less teams back then, but you got to be a big name.
Oh,
too.
Yeah. So. Clue, and then, of course, you know, he becomes Sparky's batting coach.
Yeah.
He gets hired by the Reds as batting coach in the late 60s, early 70s, and he's there for most of the big Red Machine years.
Oh, yeah.
George Foster, you know, I don't know, George completely credits Clue for that 50 home run season, but,
gives
you know,
him
Clue,
a lot. Had
Clue,
him on this podcast, yeah.
Clue had 49 home runs in 54, and over the last 3 weeks of the season, he only hit a couple. He had a bad wrist or something. He just couldn't swing. And he never hit the 50 home run mark, but he always said he felt like that when he was coaching Foster and Foster got there, that was a little
bit. Oh, that's cool. I did not know that.
He felt good about that.
That's very good. That is awesome.
Yeah.
You got Jim Maloney on the front. First of all, great man. I've gotten to know Jim over the years at some of the events, and he and his wife are just salt of the earth. But you want to talk about underrated players, pitchers, and he'd not gotten hurt.
Well, and Jim, you know, it's one of those things too. When you come along, and there's Sandy Koufax and Juan Marichal, and
right.
I mean,
he was in that era.
There were some Bob Gibson. There were some great pitchers in that era. But Maloney, when he was right, was as good as any of them.
Yeah.
He just did not have the longevity.
I wish he had a radar gun back then.
Oh, man.
Because they talk about triple digits.
And not only that, but, I mean, you talk about durability and the difference the way the game's played today, the way it was played back then. I mean, guys pitching 130, 140 pitches, and one of Jim's no-hitters, they've got the pitch count, and it's 175 pitches or whatever.
Yeah. We had a no-hitter through 10 innings.
Yeah, he threw two 10-inning no-hitters. Yes. Well, one of them.
And one of them he didn't get credit for.
One of them, he lost the no-hitter in the 11th. Yeah. The first batter in the 11th hit a home run off of him. So, officially, that wasn't a no-hitter.
Yeah.
It's like when Jim said,
but you go 10 innings,
rule.
No, yeah.
He said, I retired with three no-hitters, now I only got two. What happened?
Yeah.
But they changed the rule. And then he threw a 10-inning no-hitter up in Chicago. And Chico Cardenas won that with I think he had a home run the top of the 10th.
Yeah.
For the only and Maloney held on, getting Ernie Banks and Billy Williams, two Hall of Famers, in the bottom of the 10th. I mean, that's, you know, and you know, now you talk about, well, they're seeing the order for the second or third time or whatever. I mean, so there's Maloney, bottom of the 10th. He's probably seen these guys three or four times that day, and he still gets them both.
Well, for those that are just picking up this podcast, go back in the archives for the Jim Maloney edition on this podcast. And he is one of the greatest storytellers
Good interview.
On earth.
I'm sure he was
great. Great stories. And the story that he tells, I'll just tease it if you haven't. You go back and listen to it. Him and Johnny Bench, and it involves a cup.
Yes.
The athletic supporter type and him greasing up the ball. It's
hilarious. Yeah.
And there are tons of stories in there. Please go back in the archives and check out Jim Maloney.
Yeah.
What a,
and Jim's been great. I'll give him a shout out too for the work he's done with the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
You know, Jim was a Hall of Famer elected back in probably the 80s. But he comes to all the events that he can, and he's great with the fans. And you're right, Lynn, his wife,
Lynn,
both really
just
terrific.
A great human being, and shout out to them.
And Jim's been manager of Fantasy Camp for many years, too.
And so, he takes that seriously. I hear stories about it. The guys are on his team. He takes that seriously.
There's
no goofing around.
Yeah.
He gets ticked off if you're not performing. Anyways, all right. Peter Edward was 1963.
Boy, Jim, you are a history nerd. 63.
Yeah.
Pete comes up, not supposed to come up.
Right.
Just
second
baseman. He got an invite to spring training. Nobody really expected anything. I mean, he'd only been to Double A. He hadn't even been to Triple A yet, and that was a time when very few guys jumped from Double A into the big leagues, and so he just had a great spring training. Now, he didn't have to beat out much at second base. I will say that. Don Blassengame, kind of a journeyman second baseman, had the job. But Blassengame was very popular with his teammates. And Pete, can you imagine this? He was a little bit of a hot dog in spring training.
Yeah, that's where he got his nickname, right?
Yeah, Charlie Hustle.
Charlie Hustle.
And there were it rubbed a lot of the players, the older players. He's just, look at this kid.
Look at this guy.
Yeah, a little
Look at him running down to first base on a walk.
And
spring training game, he's going in head first to third base.
They were not that crazy about Pete, the players. But Fred Hutchinson, who was a manager, said, you know, if I had any guts at all, I'll just put Pete in the lineup and stick with him.
Yeah.
And that's ended up being what happened. Pete got the nod. He was there on opening day. He played the entire season. Ends up winning Rookie of the Year.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll tell you a funny little story. Pete was in the National Guard at that point. Or the Army Reserves, and he was doing some time. He was not doing time. He did that later. he was doing his reserve duty after.
It was tax evasion, by the way, in case you're wondering.
After the season, he was at Fort Knox, And he got the word that he had been elected Rookie of the Year while he was sloshing suds, you know, doing KP duty at whatever. And he said, I didn't have any champagne or bubbly. He said, I just threw a little more water in the soapy suds, and that's celebrated my Rookie of the Year award.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, we got Bench here. When he came up, now you want to talk about a little cocky now. He was
The little general.
Yeah, the little general.
He deserved that title when he first came up. He was letting everybody know. That's the amazing thing about like a Frank Robinson, age 20 when he comes up.
Yeah.
Johnny Bench, age 18 or 19. 18. Yeah. I mean, he's Rookie of the Year. His, 19 or 20 there in 68. It's amazing the precociousness of these guys to be able to play that well at that age. But you're absolutely right. Bench had tremendous confidence. And, in fact, I heard a story when he walked into the Reds clubhouse and somebody introduced him to the backup catcher. He said, oh, you better be careful. Bench is looking for your job. And Bench turned around to Johnny Edwards, who was the number one catcher, and said, no, I'm looking for his job.
He's a teenager.
So
I love it.
Bench knew what he was looking for, that's for sure.
Well, he knew how
and,
good he was.
And, by 1970, he's rookie of the – not rookie of the year, he's MVP.
MVP, yeah.
And, Johnny was drafted pretty late. Considering he was drafted in the second round, and that's not late.
Yeah.
But – there were seven catchers picked before Johnny Bench in the 1965 draft.
I want to tell you how those scouts feel.
He was still on the board. And about four of them never played in the major leagues at all. But, he was from Binger, Oklahoma.
Binger, little small town in Oklahoma. Right. You've got to have a scout that is there.
Exactly.
There wasn't travel ball back then.
No. And the other thing, too, you went on the wrong day, you might see Bench playing shortstop or pitching, and he was not nearly as impressive out there as he was behind the plate.
Right.
The Reds caught him three or four. I mean, they saw him play three or four times. Yeah. They saw him catch. And he didn't start off that high on their board, but the more they saw him, the more they liked him, and they kept moving him up. Bernie Carbo was the number one draft choice for the Reds in 1965. They had already zeroed in on Bernie, and then Bench starts making his way up the board. And there was an argument about, are we going to move him up? No, we'll leave him at number two. And we scouted him well. We had him rated high, but then we got a little lucky that all those catchers were picked.
Bernie Carbo almost came back to bite us in 75.
Oh, that's right.
That's another story with the Red Sox. All right, I'm going to put you on the spot again. This might be hard to nail down. 50s and 60s, you got a favorite team?
For the Reds in those
period. It doesn't have to be. I mean, obviously, 61, they go to the World Series and lose to the Yankees, and that they took the town by.
I would say the 61 season was a great season to write about, and brought back a lot of memories to me because I was 15, and that was so fresh in my memories, and any seasons with Jim Brosnan, who was wacky relief pitcher from Cincinnati, elder high guy. And Jim was the one that wrote the two books that predated Jim Bouton's Ball Four, Long Season and Pennant Race, two of the first baseball diaries.
Yeah.
And his stuff was great to look through, too, for this book.
I bet.
That was very helpful. But I suppose in a way it's a favorite, but it's most bittersweet season was 64, when the Reds came within a game of winning the pennant. They lost the game. They lost the pennant on the final day of the season to the Cardinals. And the Cardinals, Phillies, and Reds had a three-way race down the last 2 weeks of the season, and the Reds just came up short. But that was the year that Fred Hutchinson, the manager of the Reds, whose number one is on the facade and number retired, he's in our Reds Hall of Fame. Hutch was a bear of a guy, very aggressive. It was said of Fred Hutchinson that he doesn't throw chairs, he throws rooms. Hutch is really a happy guy. His face just doesn't know it yet.
His face just doesn't know it yet. I'm going to steal that line. I've never heard that one. I can't believe I haven't read that somewhere.
Hutch was tough as nails, and the players really loved him. I mean, most of the players really loved the guy. But Hutch is diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah.
early in the off season, '64. Mm-hmm. His brother was an oncologist of all, I mean, just coincidentally, yeah. out in the Seattle area where Fred grew up. And so he got great care, but it was just too far mm-hmm. gone. And he tried to manage that most of that '64 season, but by August, you know, he came out to change pitchers. His uniform's just hanging off of him, and he was not doing yeah. well. And he finally stepped aside, and Dick Sisler managed the club the last 6 weeks or so. And then Fred passed away 2 months after the season was over. So it was a great season in the sense that the Reds were in a hot pennant race, but then to lose on the last day of the season, yeah. and then 2 months later to lose your manager, that was a tough year.
Yeah.
So when I say it was my favorite, not really my favorite year.
Yeah, I know, I get
but,
it.
But, you know, one of the most memorable yeah. and one of the more interesting years to write about for the book.
Yeah, I bet. Now, the Reds did those throwback uniforms
yeah.
that year, which I thought was great. I loved it. During this time period, 50s and 60s, and I'll tell you what my favorite uniforms were of the throwbacks. And it's probably not a popular opinion. I don't know why. They were my favorite. I'll explain why they're my favorite. But if you had,
we're waiting for that. I mean, I am anxious to hear that.
Okay. Because, what were your favorite unis from this period?
Well, you know, the
because fans love uniforms.
The stories behind the 56 uniform was the 50. I can't remember now when they made that switch. 54, I guess, when they went to the vest style.
The vest, yeah.
And they did that because the old uniforms, Clue was getting so
too
pumped
tight.
Up, too tight. He cut the sleeves off just arbitrarily, just himself.
Yeah.
And the next year they'd said, okay, we're all going with a sleeveless look. So they go to that sleeveless vest. And I thought that was really a sharp look.
Yeah.
It was not widely popular when they first debuted it. They criticized the guys. They looked like they got, you know, undershirts on.
Well, the Pete Rose one right here with the name down below the,
yeah, and then
that's a little strange.
They kept that vest style for several years,
yeah.
and then when names came in,
yeah.
when it became more popular to put names on in '63, I think the Reds, I don't know why, everybody else had them above the number,
yeah.
but the Reds put them below the number. So
yeah.
it's a very distinctive look there.
It is a distinctive look.
Yeah.
All right, my favorite uniforms
yeah.
of the throwbacks. It's because they looked so clean. From a distance on TV, they popped, and even in the stadium, they popped. And they're very simple and they're very clean. But the 1969 uniforms,
pinstripes.
No, they were
weren't
the,
they
were the home ones, which were just all
yes.
white with
yeah.
a very simple logo.
Yeah. yeah, and that red belt.
And they looked so good yeah. that day on TV and in the stadium. And that's probably an unpopular opinion because they were.
Well,
of all they wore, they were probably people would say, oh, they're the most bland. They looked great, and I wish they would go back to that type of look.
Yeah, well, you're right. Sometimes simplicity is the way the way to go. But I just remember that bright red belt. That was very – it really stood out.
I just thought those
you know, there was a
great.
Time, there was a time when the Reds wore blue uniforms.
Oh, yeah.
What the heck are the – well, the reds and blue uniforms.
Yeah.
It was very short-lived in the early 1900s. But
yeah.
what are they doing in blue uniforms?
But the and this is right in the wheelhouse of the 50s during that scare. The
right.
The Cold War.
Scare, the
yeah.
Red scare.
Where all of a sudden the you know yeah. they were calling them the Russians. They were calling them the Reds.
Well,
and then all of a sudden the Reds tried to get away with it and implemented some blue into the uniform.
That's the reason why the book is called Red Leg Memories is because it was 53
went,
or so.
Went
they,
back to it.
They went got away from the name Red and went with Red Legs.
Yeah.
And that was true up until about 1958 when they changed it back. But, you know, it didn't really catch on. A lot of the press, you know, you're calling the game and you kept calling them the Reds just
Reds,
out of habit.
Yeah.
Plus the fact some of the press just refused to do it. They thought it was a silly reason because of the communist scare and somebody was
yeah.
going to confuse the Cincinnati Reds with the Russian Reds.
Right.
And so they never acknowledged it. And so finally, in the late 50s, the rest just gave it up. But, you know, I think Bob Castellini, I know, was a big Reds fan, of course, growing up in the 40s and 50s. And he remembered that Red Leg era. And I always was very fond of it. I love that name. And so, you know, they brought back the Red Leg mascot and Mr. Red Legs and went to calling the club the Red Legs occasionally and stuff. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. Now, you were the former executive director of the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum. You had a big part of getting what is now the great, outside of Cooperstown, in my mind, the greatest baseball museum.
I couldn't disagree. I will not disagree. Yeah. Couldn't agree with you more.
What was it like to put that together?
Well, I'll tell you, it was like having a baby. We got the call, and it was 9 months, man. It was 9 months. We got the call to get started. And then I had done some consulting work and some planning work and so forth, but we were just waiting to get the approval to go, let's go with this. And I got a call in January, I think, from John Allen, the Reds president there right at the end of the Marge year. Well, and for when Carl Linder owned
Carl
the club,
Linder,
John was the day-to-day, he was the CEO of the club. And John calls me and says, hey, can you come to work next Thursday? We're ready to get started on this museum. So it was a pretty quick, I mean, it's like, okay, we got to shift gears now. We're really going to get going. And so I started in February, I think, and Mr. Linder wanted the museum. Now, this was the year after the ballpark had opened. Originally, the museum was going to be part of the 2003 grand opening, but because of budget issues and so forth, they got pushed to 2004. And
which
so,
wasn't a bad thing because you got your own headlines.
Yeah, it was okay.
Yeah.
But he wanted to get it open before the end of the season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, at that point, we just had a shell of a building. That was it. We didn't have any build out. We just were starting from scratch. And although we had some exhibit ideas, now we had a real budget. So we had to go back into some of those grandiose exhibit ideas and come up with some other things. And so, and then the other thing, Jim, it's really interesting. Ball clubs they're not, you know, you're a history guy, you like history museums, you go to history museums, you see a lot of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Ball clubs don't keep a lot of stuff. They don't have room for it. They're not in that business. Right. The players usually took stuff or they would recycle the uniforms through the minor leagues. So when it came time to sort of look in the Reds' vault, as it were, there wasn't a lot
much going on. Yeah.
So it was like, now we got, you know, 15,000 square feet. What the heck are we going to, you know, going to put in here? And so we had to really go out to the community and build relationships with the collectors and with former players and with other people in order to get stuff in. And originally a lot of that stuff came in on loan and it was great. I mean, people were very generous. And so we were able to, you know, put the exhibits together and we came up with the idea for the wall of balls, Pete's 4,256 hits.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you my favorite story about that. Jimmy O'Toole, great pitcher for the Reds in the 60s. And Bob Perkey. Same time period.
Rag him up and steam as well.
And you're right. Perkey, O'Toole had been in to see the museum several times. Mm-hmm. He knew what the wall of balls was, right? He'd seen it.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't, I mean, there's 4,256 baseballs on the southern wall of the Reds Hall of Fame. And it just stretches from three floors high. It's a great exhibit.
Yeah.
So Bob Perkey came into town to visit for an autograph signing, and Jim invited Bob to come over to the Hall of Fame and see the Hall of Fame. So we're walking through the hall, and we get around to the wall of balls, and Bob kind of looks at it. Perkey kind of looks at it with this question mark on his face, and O'Toole puts his arm around Jim around Bob Perkey, and he says, "Bob, you see all those balls up there? Those are all the home runs you gave up to Willie Mays."
Jim O'Toole was another character.
He was great.
Great storyteller.
But
met his family, great family.
Yeah. And he had 11 kids, by the way, O'Toole did.
When I met his family, it took a minute.
Well, yeah, I always joked with Jim that was a club record. I mean, I really don't know if it was a club record, but prove me wrong, right? You got 11 kids. That's a
Jim
club
O'Toole,
record. I mean, God, the O'Toole family come into town for a ball game, they'd buy 50 seats.
no question.
But anyway, that's so putting great. The Hall of Fame together was a kick.
It was
a dream come true. Yeah. And
labor, you know, of love. I mean, not even really a job.
And the players were turned, you know, just I didn't know many of those guys before I started, and beginning to know them and working with them over the years was a great experience. Yeah. And now Rick Walls has been director a lot longer than I was ever director, and Rick's done a terrific job moving the Hall of Fame ahead and keeping it going. So
kudos to all of them to everyone that's involved with it. And if you haven't made your way through, if you're coming to a ball game, even if you're not, you've got, if you're a Reds fan, you've got to go to the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum.
In fact, I always say sometimes it's better to come not when it's a ball game because it's less
more
crowded.
Time.
And secondly, if you do the ballpark tour, you can get into, sometimes you can get into areas of the ballpark that aren't open on a game day. If you're doing the ballpark
tour. I was blown away. They've got a little broadcasting section in
there
now.
Yeah, I think where you're in there, aren't you?
My picture's in there. I'm like, I am not worthy to be in this. Not that I'm not in the, for that reason, I'm just one of the broadcasters, and you can actually broadcast an inning.
Call an inning with Jim Day. Seriously, how good does it get?
So it's, I walked in there and I saw my picture. I'm like, I was overwhelmed as a kid that, you know, my first love was the Cincinnati Reds and still my love. Just to be a very small part, I was blown away by it. So I'm just floating through this book right now, and the pictures itself are worth the buy. Oh, there's Nuxie. 1952. So again, he goes through every year, the 50s and 60s. It is Red Legs Memories, the Reds of the 50s and 60s by Greg Rhodes, and get it on Amazon or the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum. Great visit. I need to have you back because, what, you got 9 books?
Well, we still got the old Crosley Field, and we talked about that a little bit, but the more about the Big Red Machine years. We've got the old 69, the Red Stockings and the Birth of Professional, the first night game. Oh, yeah, we could do another one.
I will definitely have you back. You've been on my list, but this is fresh because, again, Father's Day coming up, and it doesn't have to be a Father's Day gift. Just gift yourself if you're a Reds fan to get
this book
from Greg Rhodes.
I will definitely
have you back, and we will talk about the Big Red Machine and the Red Stockings and there's so much I could.
The first Big Red Machine.
I could talk to you for hours and hours, Greg. Yeah. But
well, you know, you're a fellow history nerd. I really appreciate
it. Oh, I love it. I love it, man. This will be I wish that I had the book before we did this because I could say, oh, I love this story. But when I have you back, I'll say, hey, oh, I love this story because I guarantee you I'm going to be reading this bad boy soon. So,
all right.
Appreciate the visit. That is Greg Rhodes, everyone. Hope you enjoyed this walk back in time in Reds history here on the Jim Day Podcast. And we shall see you next time. Cam Miller, play us on out of here. Baseball prison.